one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
Swung on,
did it,
crushed, and the Phillies are going to lead it.
Harper, the swing of his life.
The 0-2 pitch, swing and a miss, struck him out.
From WHYY, it is hitting season. Hey there, podcast pals. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on X and Blue Sky at John Stolness. Coming up, what a week in Washington for the Phillies. Yes, they dropped the opener on Monday, looking kind of dead while they did it. But over the last two nights, Tuesday night and Wednesday night, late inning magic, ninth inning heroes, the cardiac kids, the 2026 Philadelphia Phillies have been electrifying the fan base with two tremendous ninth inning comebacks against the Washington Nationals. So we're going to talk about that coming up here in the next few minutes as the Phillies are, they do have one more game left in this four game series on Thursday night, but what a wild two nights in the nation's capital. I'm going to be joined a little bit later in the show by my hitting season co-host Justin Clue, but we're going to take a deep dive into his new book, Summer of the Cheap Wieners. You've heard us talk a lot about it here on the podcast just in passing, but for those of you who have not bought a copy yet, this is going to be the hard sell because it's a fantastic book. It's so much fun. It's a fun baseball book, and it's about the Phillies, which, again, there's not a lot out there about the Phillies that's really creative and really dives into some stuff that you've never heard of before. So we're going to talk to Justin about that. And I'm also going to be joined by my eldest son, my 15-year-old son, Ethan, who you all know as a super Nats fan. He is our Nationals insider here on the Hit and Season podcast. So we're going to get his thoughts over the last couple of nights. And let me just tell you, it's tough for a young guy who loves his baseball team to lose a couple of games like that. So I'm not dancing on the grave too much here of the Washington Nationals. Because I've got a young buck who this has been pretty hard for. So lots to get to here on this edition of Hittin' Season. But let's dive right in to the games here on Tuesday night and Wednesday night. Obviously, I'm going to start with the most recent. Let's start with Wednesday night. Because I know you've probably all seen the videos of the big Tuesday night comeback. But on Wednesday night, the Phillies followed up that tremendous ninth inning rally with yet another one. Entering the ninth inning, trailing 4-3, the Nationals get the first two outs of the inning, and this time it wasn't Brad Lord who was victimized by the Phillies here. No, in this case it was a left-hander, Richard Lovelady. The Nationals stayed away from Brad Lord. He pitched a lot in the game on Tuesday. So in the eighth inning, they called on right-hander Orlando Ribalta to get the final out of the final two outs. Yeah, no, the final out of the of the eighth inning, and then he started the ninth inning, the right-hander, and he got the first two outs of the ninth inning. But then the Phillies called on Kyle Schwarber to pinch hit with nobody on and two outs, trailing by a run. And as a result, the Nationals bring in one of their lefty relievers, a guy with a 3.90 ERA on the season. Now, the whip is 1.83, so the ERA probably should be a whole lot higher. But Richard Lovelady's a left-hander, and we all know the Phillies' issues with left-handers. They bring in Lovelady to face Kyle Schwarber, who did not start the game. Second straight game, he did not start because of some discomfort in his lower back, but he felt better as the day went on and felt good enough to pinch hit. He works a tremendous nine-pitch walk. Tremendous walk from Kyle Schwarber in that spot. And so with Justin Crawford due up at the plate, Don Mattingly decides to go to the right-hander, center fielder Derek Hill, who was signed by the team just a couple of weeks ago to give them another right-handed bat with Adolis Garcia hitting the injured list for the rest of the season with the torn lat. Derek Hill, who, I mean, when they signed Derek Hill, no one really thought, hey, this is a guy who's going to be featured in the postseason highlight video somewhere. It kind of felt like a guy who was here for a little bit, who would be here for a little bit, wouldn't do a whole lot, would hit like 180 or something like that, and would just kind of disappear from our lives when the Phillies promoted somebody else or added somebody else. But here comes Derek Hill with Kyle Schwarber having worked a walk. Garrett Stubbs pinch runs for Kyle Schwarber. And he comes to the plate with two outs, trailing 4-3. And he smokes a Lovelady fastball over the right center field seats. I mean, it didn't get over by a lot, but it's an opposite field's two-run shot. Again, the Phillies were down to their final strike with Kyle Schwarber at the plate and with Derek Hill up at the plate. For the second straight night, they do this. Down to their final strike. And Derek Hill launches a shocking two-run home run over the right center field wall to give the Phillies a 5-4 lead. Again, the win probability near 0% when Kyle Schwarber was up at the plate. And the Phillies figure out a way to win their second straight game down to their final strike, trailing in the ninth inning, seemingly dead. They rise from the mat like the Undertaker. Paul Bunyan on the other side of the ropes, holding the urn, channeling the Undertaker to rise again. The Phillies, like a phoenix, rise from the ashes and take down a Washington Nationals team that suffers two absolutely heartbreaking, gut-wrenching losses, as tough of two regular season losses as you can have. And we'll get into the one on Tuesday here in just a second. For a young team like that, to suffer those losses back-to-back, it's almost like, you know, it's getting baptized in the ways of becoming a good baseball team. And for the Phillies, it's obviously, you know, they've struggled with left-handers tremendously. This is really the first big moment by a right-handed hitter against a lefty reliever in a clutch situation like this that I can remember this year. They have been really bad against left-handers. The Nationals had to feel good about that matchup. Lovelady against Derek Hill. I would have felt good about that matchup if I were them. But the Phillies are just playing with some kind of magic right now, guys. That's all you can really say. They are playing with some kind of magic. It does feel a little bit 2022-ish, late 2022-ish right now. Because again, this was a team that has struggled against the best in baseball, but are figuring out a way to beat everybody else right now. And they're getting contributions from everyone. Right now, everyone up and down the lineup is contributing. On Tuesday, it was Bryson Stott with the huge three-run home run that put them on top 11-8. But it was preceded by Brandon Marsh in his breakout all-star season, coming through with the huge two-run home run to tie that game after the Phillies and Nationals were riding the seesaw back and forth on Tuesday night. And a game just filled with wild swings of emotion. And the Phillies figured out a way to come out on top. 8 two-out runs in the ninth inning. Not a single man on base. First two guys are recorded. Out, out. Strikeout, strikeout. And then the Phillies come back and they do what they did on Tuesday night. And then here on Wednesday night to do it again. And with the Nationals, with the Braves getting swept by the San Diego Padres, the Phillies now just 4.5 games back of the Atlanta Braves in the National League East. They were once 11 games behind Atlanta back in May when they hit 9-19 and the losing streak was, you know, the 10 game losing streak. That's the dark days. But it just goes to, we all need to remember as fans, just in this marathon of a season, how one thing or one or two things can totally flip the script. Don Mattingly takes over for Rob Thompson, serves as a wake-up call to the team. But perhaps just as importantly, Zach Wheeler returns to the starting rotation. Those two things happened pretty much around the same time. And the Phillies have not looked back ever since. They are now, 35-17 after their 9-19 start. That is the best record in baseball. And the Braves have now lost 7 of 10. So now finally, as the Phillies are on this run, the Phillies are finally taking advantage of it in the standings, as the Braves, for the first time this season, are having their first little slump. And so here we go. We've got a race in the National League East again. The Phillies lead the wild card pack at the moment, but they are back in it in the National League East after Wednesday night's incredible victory. The Phillies are the only major league team in the modern era to be down to their last strike with nobody on base in the ninth inning, two games in a row, and win both. If you want to look and see how crazy these last two games have been, no one has ever done what the Phillies have done these last two nights. The only team in Major League Baseball history, in the modern era, 1900s, to be down to their last strike with nobody on base in the ninth inning, two games in a row, and win them both. It's interesting, too. Like, the Phillies have not had a walk-off home run at Citizens Bank Park in something like 2.5-3 years or something like that. But they're doing this on the road. They would have had a walk-off win, walk-off home run with the Bryson Stott homer on Tuesday, or last night with the Derek Hill home run. But they're happening on the road. So not walk-off, but essentially the same effect. These ninth-inning go-ahead home runs the last two nights, it's been a legendary turn for this team here over the last couple of nights. And you have to go back to Tuesday as well. Just a crazy game. Trailed 5-0 after the fourth inning. They trailed 5-3 with two outs in the eighth. Two strikes on JT Realmuto, who is hitting around 200, hitting under the Mendoza line in the worst offensive season of his career. Before he hits a line drive to right field that I'm telling you, James Wood had that ball nestled in his glove. He was out. Realmuto is out. Wood made an unbelievable diving play. But as he's sliding, as he's doing a slip and slide on his belly, sliding towards the foul line, the ball in his glove, it squirts out. He just couldn't hold on to it. And you can see him mouthing. I don't know if he mouthed the swear words, like, oh man, oh no, or something. Because the ball squirts away. And then as he tries to pick it up quickly and keep the Phillies from scoring the go-ahead run, keep the runner at third, he accidentally swipes the ball away from him with the glove. And it gets away, and three runners score. The Phillies take the lead. But then the Nationals answer right back. Orion Kerkering gives up a three-run home run in the bottom of the eighth. The first three runners all score. I mean, it took no time at all for the Nationals to answer back. And it just felt like, okay, not the Phillies' night. Big hit from Realmuto. Got to feel good about that, but not the Phillies' night. They fall behind 8-6, entering the ninth. First two guys strike out. Trey Turner down to his last strike. Just feels like Nationals are going to pull this out. And then Turner gets a single. Big hit from Turner, who had a terrible defensive game. It was a big reason why Jesus Luzardo gave up four runs in the fourth inning. In the third inning, pardon me. Yeah, no, in the fourth inning. Yeah, in the fourth inning. Gave up those four runs and trailed 5-0. But he comes through with a two-strike single to left center. And then Brandon, and then, you know, Lord just left an absolute meatball hanger over the middle of the plate. And Brandon Marsh did not miss it. He has not missed much this year. And he absolutely did not miss that pitch either. And then, of course, you have the Phillies then starting to pile it on. Brad Lord can't get anybody out. Bryson Stott comes to the plate with two runners on and hits a three-run home run that he somehow keeps inside that right field foul line. I don't know how he did it, but he Carlton Fisk that thing inside the right field foul line. Over his last 15 games coming into Wednesday, he's hitting .333 with a .410 on base percentage and a .519 slugging percentage. And in the game on Wednesday, Stott went 1-for-4 with another double. He continues to hit. His OPS on the season. I mean, he's come a long way. An OPS of 702 now on the season. He was in the 500s for most of the first 2 months of the season. The last time Stott's OPS was in the 700s was on March 29th, the third game of the season. In June, coming into Wednesday, hitting .304 in June with a .385 on base and a .464 slugging percentage. So it looks like Stott is, I'm not going to say Stott is fixed, Stott is great, Stott is back, but he is locked in right now. And just some numbers from Tuesday. You may have heard these numbers already, but I'm going to throw them at you anyway. 8 runs across the plate after the second out of the ninth inning. That's tied for the 5th most runs scored with 2 outs in a ninth inning since 1920. 10 straight base runners got on base with 2 outs in that 8th inning. And the Phillies were just the 6th team since 1920 to score 8 or more runs with 2 outs in the ninth inning while trailing. No team had done it in 38 years. The last National League team to do it was the 1928 Boston Braves. That number came from Matt Gelb in The Athletic. And a little bit of a shout out for Edmundo Sosa in this game on Tuesday night, because he did all his good work early, and then after the party kind of really was done, he didn't have, you know, the three biggest hits that we've been talking about, the Realmuto three-run double, the Brandon Marsh two-run home run, and the Bryson Stott three-run home run, but filling in for Kyle Schwarber, who again had the lower back issue, Sosa gets added to the game as the designated hitter minutes before first pitch. And he comes in, gets the Phillies when they're trailing 5-0, gets them on the board, gets them going with a 5th inning 2-run home run. Then he hits an RBI fielder's choice for the team's 3rd run, and then almost hits a 3-run home run in the 9th inning, but settles for a 2-run double off the tippy top of the wall. He had 5 RBIs in the game in Kyle Schwarber's place. So a 5 RBI game from Edmundo Sosa, and it's like storyline number 4 or 5. In that game on Tuesday. So just a really unbelievable turn of events. We're going to talk to Ethan here in just a second about this Nationals bullpen. But none of this would have been possible without the Nationals fielding the worst bullpen in baseball. And I have some numbers on the bullpen, and we'll talk about that with Ethan coming up here in just a second. But the Phillies do have one more game to play here in their series against against the Nationals. And I got to say, if you're the Nationals, you might have an issue today. Christopher Sanchez tonight takes the mound for the Phillies, but the Nationals have one of their best starters, a guy who has pitched very well against the Phillies in the past. Cade Cavalli will get the start, a right-hander. So the Phillies do pretty well against right-handers. A 4.07 ERA on the season for Cavalli with a 1.46 whip. On the surface, looking at the numbers, this is the type of pitcher the Phillies should do well against, but Cavalli has pitched well against the Phils in the past. So we'll see if the Nationals can maybe steal this last game and settle for a split, which I think would do wonders for them. The Phillies, I think, would still leave Washington, D.C. feeling pretty good about themselves. And look, if you're a young team like the Nationals, you've played the Phillies really well in this series. The bullpen blew, just flat out blew two games they should have won. So if I'm a Nationals fan, I'm not feeling too bad about that. And I'm going to try to help my son feel better about that as well. And we're going to welcome him in here now. And I'm joined by Nationals insider for Hittin' Season, Ethan Stolness. Yes, my 15-year-old son, who is as knowledgeable on this team as any of those fools who write about the team that you'll see online someplace. But Ethan's going to join us to talk about the series and the rough couple of nights for Nationals fans here on Tuesday night and Wednesday night. Ethan, it's good to have you back on the show.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me on, Dad.
It's always fun to have you on, buddy. And so I know that these last two nights have been... Listen, I was a kid once, too. And I watched some pretty bad Phillies teams, like in the 80s and in the 90s. There's a Phillies team, I think it was in 2020, where we had a bullpen, the worst bullpen in baseball history. In terms of ERA and blown saves, it was the worst bullpen in baseball history. So Phillies fans... Even recent Phillies fans understand what Nationals fans are going through right now. But just as an analyst and a fan, talk to me about the last couple of nights. How difficult was it watching Brad Lord and Love Lady give it up the way they did the last couple of nights?
To be honest, I could feel it coming. This is just the sort of thing that happens to the Nationals all the time. That's just them. I've seen this happen so many times. And I really didn't think Brad Lord was going to self-destruct like he did. He's usually a good reliever. He's probably our best reliever. He can go like four innings at a time, and he can play the part of a closer, and he almost did it. He needed one more strike. And then he threw a fat pitch to one of the best pure contact hitters in baseball. And... then he just self-destructed, and it was just heartbreaking to watch because it's just, I knew it was going to happen. I could feel it happening because my Nationals intuition was telling me they're going to blow it like they usually do. And then later that night, it was the exact same thing. And I checked the score, and they were once again down to their last strike. And I was like, okay, I'm going to walk away. I think I can trust him. And I come back and then I look at your phone and I'm like, again? How on earth did this happen again? I think it makes it even more, all the more bitter because they're a good team now and they needed these wins because the Phillies are their main contender for second and first place right now.
Yeah, I mean, the Nationals are right there in the wild card race. But you said that, you know, a couple of times, like, you knew this would happen. They've done it before. And, yeah, the Washington Nationals have blown 24 saves as a team this year. No other team in baseball has blown more than 16. And one of the things about the Nationals' bullpen right now, Ethan, and I think this is the problem that we've seen these last couple of nights with them, is they can't strike anybody out. They don't have any big electric arms in the bullpen. I did not look up these stats. Somebody else looked up these stats and had this. And I apologize. I don't have the person's name who did this. I should have written that down, but I didn't because I'm a bad podcast host. But they have the lowest swing and miss rate in Major League Baseball.
Sounds about right.
They are on pace to become one of just six teams since 2008, since StatCast started recording this stuff, to miss less than 20% of bats with two strikes. And so what that means is when a Nationals pitcher gets two strikes on a hitter, they are only getting a swing and a miss less than 20% of the time. That is an extremely low rate. When you're a reliever and you get somebody at two strikes, most teams have relievers that can put hitters away and get a third strike, get strikeouts that way. The Nationals have the fewest amount of those, the lowest rate of that in baseball. Their bullpen ranks 30th, dead last, in Fangraph's Stuff Plus metric, which looks at all the pitcher's raw stuff, like how electric is their fastball? How much does their breaking ball spin? How much does it curve? How much vertical and horizontal drop does it have? And there are 82 pitchers in Major League Baseball who have thrown at least five innings and have their fastball average 97 miles an hour. The Nationals have none of them. So this is the mission for the Washington Nationals here at the trade deadline, Ethan. I think they're going to stick around as a potential wildcard team because their offense is good. They are a pesky bunch. They have good at-bats. They work their walks. They hit the ball up the middle. They have a couple of superstars in James Wood and C.J. Abrams. The starting pitching is doing enough because their offense has done so well. They can't continue to have the bullpen work like this, but I think this is a problem that they can solve at the trade deadline. But I mean, I think, would you agree that this is the main goal at the trade deadline is to get at least two relievers that can do some of the stuff that I just mentioned, strike guys out?
Absolutely. I hope that if they don't, I'm going to be really mad, but they usually make me mad, but I like them so much anyway. But yeah, I don't see how it's possible for them to be a contender and still have a record over 500, and then at the trade deadline not fix the most pressing problem, which is obviously the bullpen, because we have the best offense in baseball, so we don't really need to do anything with that. Like you said, the starters have been doing enough. They haven't been awesome, but they have been okay. And we have prospects. We've got a lot of prospects. We've got a great minor league system, and I wouldn't mind seeing a couple of the Nationals, like 10 shortstops, being traded to get some pitching.
Yeah, the Nationals have a lot of shortstops. Eli Willits, it's one of the reasons why C.J. Abrams' future in Washington is a little bit cloudy, but he's not going anywhere as long as the Nationals are playing like this. But yeah, it's been a really hard first couple of nights. But I was just saying before you came in here that if I'm a Nationals fan, you should be feeling pretty good about this series against the Phillies. Just if you can set aside the heartbreak, because they should have won all three games really in this series. The Nationals should have won all three games in this series. They are two blown saves, one strike away each night from taking the first three games in the series. And as Phillies fans, we feel good because it's, you know, hey, this team picks itself up off the mat, you know, but the Nationals did that on Tuesday night. They got the big three-run home run after the Phillies hit the big three-run double after Realmuto got the double, and it just slid out of James Wood's glove, and then they answer right back in the bottom of the eighth with a big three-run home run. That felt like a key moment for them in this season, and it just didn't work out. But if the Nationals are playing the Phillies really well in this series, these bullpen blow-ups aside.
They are. I'm very proud of them. I am, and it's. After many years, it's fun to watch the Nationals for the first time since 2019. 7 years, it's actually fun to watch them again. I'm not ashamed to call myself a Nationals fan. I'm glad that they're doing so well. I do feel like there was a lot of bad luck here. Is that accurate? Because I don't understand the physics as to how that ball popped out of James Wood's glove. I don't. He had it in the pocket. I guess maybe his hand slammed down on the ground when he did his slide, but I just don't get how that ball popped out. It just kind of felt like there was something there. There was just something that was cursing the Nationals. I mean, don't forget that the game against the Giants also, where they blew an 8-run lead and gave up a walk-off grand slam. It's just, It's just the kind of stuff that the Nationals happened. It always seems to happen to them. It always seems to happen to them, but I think that their luck is going to change, especially if they can start relying on bullpen instead of luck.
Yeah, and that's, and again, that's why the trade deadline has to be all about the bullpen for the Nationals. And the good news is that usually at the trade deadline, that's what there are the most of. There are a lot of relievers who are available, and so there should be some guys. And it's interesting, they have such a good farm system, but they haven't been able to bring, they haven't brought anybody up from the farm system that has the kind of dynamic stuff that most bullpens have to kind of get guys to swing and miss. But they do have prospects, and they can, if they fix this and even just become a middle of the pack bullpen, the Nationals are going to be a dangerous little team, a pesky little team to deal with right now. And it is fun, more fun to be a Nationals fan right now. Now, tell us a little bit about Cade Cavalli. His ERA is over 4. He's going to be the starting pitcher tonight against Christopher Sanchez. Give us a little scouting report on Cade Cavalli, because I know he's pitched pretty well against the Phillies in the past.
Yeah, I think he was in the first game matchup with Christopher Sanchez earlier in the season. I don't remember how he did. I think he got the loss. I don't think he did particularly well. He's just, Cavalli has had some trouble this year. Last year he was really good. He had great stuff. He still has great stuff this year, but he has not been able to, he just hasn't had it this year. He's won a couple games. I think his problem right now is he's streaky. It's one bad start, followed by a good start, followed by a bad start, followed by a good start. And it's just going to be hard to tell what he's going to be, because last time he pitched, he only went 2 1/3 innings, and I think he gave up 6 runs. I don't remember who that was against. It was against Tampa Bay.
In that game against Tampa Bay, he only went 2 2/3, but he gave up 2 runs in that game, 6 hits, but only gave up 2 runs in that game. But his pitch count got up there because he was a little bit inefficient. And against the Phillies earlier in the year, the Nationals did lose that game in 10 innings, but Cavalli went 6 innings and only gave up 1 run against the Phillies, 5 hits, 1 run, 2 walks, and 3 strikeouts. So Cavalli pitched well in that game. Again, that was a game where the bullpen wasn't able to hold the lead.
Again, it seems like the Phillies have like a luck advantage over the Nationals, and I know that the Phillies have a superior team, as much as I don't like to admit it. I know we have the superior offense, but you definitely have the superior pitching. But yeah, I forgot about that game. I forgot about that walk off where it was Justin Crawford hit that walk off hit. I forgot that was Cavalli pitching, but. Like I said, that kind of, he's been streaky. It's been like one good start followed by a not so great start. And I think he's historically been good against the Phillies. Mm-hmm. I think he's won most of his games. So we'll see how it goes tonight. And I kind of feel like if they don't win this game, then the whole series is just going to be a wanna forget, because this has just been such a frustrating series for them, and they should be up 3-0 right now, and I feel like they should deserve to come out with a split series.
How will you feel if they win this game here on Thursday? How will you feel about the series if it does end up being a split? Good, bad, mediocre?
I would feel really good, because they've been playing so well. If they win today, then it should have been
and
a
beat
sweep.
Christopher Sanchez doing it.
Yeah, that would be awesome to show that they really do have a fantastic offense. I do think it would be really good, because the Nationals are proving themselves against a really good baseball team after all this time, and against the Phillies, who they have for the past years been really struggling with beating the Phillies. If they win today, like I said, it should have been a series sweep, and I will feel super great about their chances going into the next series.
So last question, Ethan, how do you feel about their chances of making a wild card? They're 2.5 back right now. There's a lot of teams that they're battling with, but you know, it's a pretty flawed National League. How do you feel about their chances of actually snagging maybe that last wild card this year?
The optimist in me says, I think they can do it. If a lot of stuff goes right, if they do get a bullpen and it starts probably performing above what is expected, and what it should be, if they go above and beyond, and that might just be luck, it might be just magic, like you said, the Phillies are playing with the magic, maybe the Nationals will catch that magic. The realist in me says, I think they're going to fall short, but it's not going to be by much. And next year, they're going to be rearing and gearing.
That's your national, your hitting season Nationals insider, Ethan Stolness, joining us here on the podcast. And Ethan joins us every time the Phillies take on the Nationals. We need an insider, guys. We need an insider. We need somebody who knows this team inside and out. And so we will always turn to Ethan for that. Ethan, thanks for joining me here upstairs in the bedroom office.
Thanks, Dad. You're welcome.
Well, in the Midweek Podcast, I typically will have on an author written a book. We've talked to authors who've written a book about Nolan Ryan. We've had a book about Pete Rose on in the past. We had Pitching Ninja on to talk about his book. And, you know, that's just something we do here on the Midweek Hitting Season Podcast sometimes. And it dawned on me, you know, why have we not had our own living, breathing author who also hosts the podcast on to talk at length about his new book, one we've mentioned a number of times here on the show. But this is the week we are going to talk to Justin Clue in depth about Summer of the Cheap Wieners, what the 1941 Phillies were up to while Joe DiMaggio was making history. And Justin, I know you know the audience well. I don't need to say welcome to Hittin' Season, but, you know, let's talk about the book.
Thank you so much, John, for having me on. And yeah, it's great to have one of these author convos. And yeah, like you just said, there's a ton of great baseball books out there right now. I will say, as somebody who's read a lot of older baseball books, there is still, like, you know, plenty of new great baseball books coming out. The ones you mentioned, I just read John Miller's book on Earl Weaver. There's a lot of great stuff out there. So I'm happy to be included, unarguably, with the other great books that are out there right now.
Well, and it really is fun, and I got to let the audience behind the scenes. I got a chance to read the book even before it was published, to kind of just go give it a look and see what it looked like before it even hit the publisher fully, I think, or maybe it was in the midst of the publishing or whatever it was. But I was excited for this book to come out because it really is. It's fun. If you're a fan of the Dirty Inning podcast, I mean, you'll be a huge fan of this book because the whole 1941 season, it was a dirty season. I mean, just when the Phillies were going through, this year's Phillies were going through their historic offensive slump. Remember, they were being compared to the 1941 Phillies. I mean, seems like a long ways away from that after the weekend they just had in New York against New York. But, you know, the 1941 team was awful from top to bottom. And that's why the book is so interesting, because it makes such an unbelievably clear and sharp contrast between two teams that were playing the same sport, Justin, but not really.
Yeah, I feel like if my goal was to shine this light on a chapter of one of the many chapters of Phillies history that just does not have a lot of attention paid to it for obvious reasons. This was not a golden era, which tends to be the eras we gravitate towards when we cover history. But when you're talking about something with which people are going to be largely unfamiliar, featuring players with whom people are going to largely be unfamiliar, I felt like it was probably a good tactic to at least attach the Phillies, tether the narrative to something that is one of the most recognizable things in baseball, which is Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hit streak record, which happened to be happening that same summer. And then it takes maybe, you know, 2 minutes of looking into the summer of 1941 to realize this was actually a pretty historic season for baseball in general. And the world, you know, given that World War II was becoming obviously a louder and louder issue in Europe. And then on the baseball side of things, you obviously had DiMaggio's streak and the beginnings of that, which are always so interesting to me because the fans were kind of like turning on DiMaggio before the streak started, that he was a little too pompous, that he was paying a little too much attention to his businesses off the field, that he was a little too entitled. What is this guy giving us? And then the first hit of the streak was this little trickler. But then also in addition to that, you had Ted Williams and his big season hitting 400. You had the All-Star Game was a classic that year as well, featuring Ted Williams. You had the Brooklyn Dodgers kind of emerging from being like the bums of Brooklyn to a team that's actually going to win and give their fans what they've always wanted. So I thought, who better to tell that story through than the team to whom none of those things were happening and were actually, you know, playing very poorly and having one of their worst seasons of all time? Just dust off one of those corners of baseball history that nobody's ever going to look at and tell that story. And, you know, you find a lot of great stuff in those corners, as we've always learned on the Dirty Inning.
Well, and I was going to say, too, like, if you are someone who likes to go exploring in the woods or anything like that, you know, you may see a big rock and, you know, you think, well, there's nothing interesting under that rock. And then you lift under that rock and there's a whole world going on under there. You don't ever see it. You probably don't even want to investigate it most of the time. But there is a lot of fascinating things happening under that rock. And under that rock was the 1941 Phillies. I mean, you could see Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio. And like you said, like, it was
I still remember the Phillies are like a marquee team in baseball right now, and they have been for a little while now. But throughout most of their history, the Phillies were not a marquee team. And all you need to understand that, all you need to do is watch Ken Burns' baseball documentary, like all like 12 hours of it. And man, if the Phillies are mentioned three times in that thing for something other than throwing racial epithets at Jackie Robinson, I would be amazed if it was more than that. Like the Phillies just, you know, especially leading up into the 21st century, for most of the 20th century, were an afterthought. And no year more so than 1941. So introduce us to the 1941 Phillies. Give us one or two people that that we will become and the reader becomes intimately familiar with as they're reading the book.
Well, to your point about the Phillies having this long, long history and yet feeling underrepresented in wider portrayals of baseball, especially from this era, this was actually one of my inspirations for writing the book at all, was that when I was growing up, my parents would come home with books from like book fairs and stuff. So I wound up reading, you know, about stuff that was beyond the contemporary, what was going on in baseball, which I was watching on TV every night over the summer, but more names like Leo Durocher popping up, mm-hmm. and learning about like these eras of players and managers in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And as I'm reading these books, I'm just waiting, as I did while watching the Ken Burns documentary as a child, waiting to see what was going on with the Phillies. What's the deal with the Phillies? Who was the Phillies' best big guy at the time? Like, even the bad teams have at least, like, a big guy. And, you know, you didn't really run into that a whole lot. And I feel like that absence of the Phillies in that time, you know, eventually being explained, well, it was because they were god-awful. That is fair enough. But that also, I've come to learn, doesn't mean there wasn't, like, stories to tell from that era. So this book is at least partially written for my younger self to have some light shone on an area of the Phillies that is largely cast in darkness, and for good reason. I'll just add this. A friend's dad, who just finished the book, texted me just this past weekend, and the response stood out to me because he had exactly the reaction that I was going for in this regard, where he said, "I have been a Phillies fan for decades. Your book was like listening to an unfamiliar older distant relative who clued you into your own family history in ways you never would have expected. Many lights went on." So that is what I'm going for, is that, like, yeah, there are probably long stretches of time where you don't really know what was going on with the Phillies. It wasn't good, but you can still, you know, we're all part of the same fan base. We can be a little more familiar with even the worst parts. But to answer your question, one of the names that's featured throughout the book, there's probably about 10 or so guys whose names pop up most prominently. And I tried to introduce guys at the front of the book as well, just to give you, just to set the bar. But Gerald Nugent, the owner at the time, has always been, the ownership of the Phillies has always been so entertaining to me from this era, because you had guys coming in who just thought, like, well, you know, I'm going to fix this situation. And there's all these claims about, like, I'm not going to, you know, pinch pennies and sell players as soon as they're good. Like, the last guy, you know, I care about the game. And Nugent is kind of, I think if you read about him in history, he's generally considered less of that than guys like William Cox were. But ultimately, in execution, functionally, he was pretty much the same as far as, like, those types of owners. And so seeing him and, like, reading about him, and, like, you don't have a whole lot of times where he's just, like, out there making standard ownership claims. It was more interesting looking at the dynamic between him and Connie Mack, who was obviously owning the A's at the time, Philadelphia's other team, and sharing a stadium with them. And there's even a point in the book where we talk about it was Connie Mack Day at the field that would one day be named after Connie Mack. And, they had Nugent come out and, like, hand a plaque to him and shake his hand. And, like, they always referred to each other as friends. Like, they didn't have, like, an intense off the field rivalry as far as, like, as far as the records will tell you. But it's just funny seeing those guys, like, kind of have to stand next to each other, knowing what the situation is. One of the best quotes from the book is when they talk to the A's about the Phillies, and they're just like, honestly, we just feel bad for the Phillies. We wish there was something we could do to help them. And to me, that's the worst part. That's the worst part of being a team as bad as 111 loss 1941 Phillies team, is that, like, you have these guys out there who are like, yeah, just maybe they'll all remember their hats today and we can call that a win, because right now there's nothing you can do. So Nugent I like because he just kind of, he steps into that role and he's exactly the guy for the most part that a lot of other owners were for the Phillies. But I also like the manager, Doc Prothrow, is a big character in like more than one way. Most of the stuff that happens to people because of the Phillies happens to him. He's kind of what I would call probably the biggest casualty of the 1941 Phillies. They cost him physically at different times. He is a dentist that was in fought in a war with the dental corps. Essentially, he was recruited to be like a dentist with the military.
A war dentist, yeah.
But pretty easygoing. And like by the time he's with the Phillies, he's this dentist who is like chugging soda every day. He's like a huge soda fiend. So he's got competing parts of his personality there too. And when you just think of like generally the guy who had to sit there and watch this team every night and just see what they were going to do and try to help them and answer for them, which is the hardest part. That guy also has a very entertaining role to play in the 1941 Phillies. But as I'm always saying, the players themselves also featured tons of great names. The guy who wrote to the Phillies and said, look, I got to have an operation on my leg. If you pay for the operation,
I'll play for
the Phillies. And they were like, great. And another guy who was like, look, I'm just going to be around. Like, I'm playing on the Sandlots. You're not getting rid of me. I'm also available. And they're like, great. And then Johnny Rizzo, a guy with this huge personality that didn't quite match his statistical output, was like, yeah, you know how Joe DiMaggio is the Joe DiMaggio of the American League? I'm going to be the Johnny Rizzo of the National League. And I mean, I think anybody will tell you they're a little more familiar with DiMaggio than Johnny Rizzo. But it's just fun to me that the Phillies had this Joe DiMaggio like junior wannabe who was like, yeah, I got it. Who just did not amount to being that guy, but you know, still had all the confidence in the world. Those are the stories I love telling about a team that not only are people unfamiliar with, but also, you know, again, lost 111 games.
Well, was Johnny Rizzo their best player though?
No, I credit Nick Eaton with being one of their better hitters. He was scouted from Villanova and ultimately like wasn't signed, but he had his name slipped to Connie Mack, actually. And that's how it kind of like trickled into the Philadelphia circle. And, you know, he was slugger, you know, Sandlot slugger. A guy who like hit well at many levels. He hit really well at in the minor leagues as well. And then, you know, he had just had a couple of kids by the time he got to the Phillies. So I think he was also banking on like new dad strength as well in 1941.
Yes, yes.
But as Stan Bumgarner wrote about Nick Eaton as he was coming to the Phillies, you can't buy baby shoes with release slips. So Eaton has his best foot poised.
In the old time newspaper writing, too, about teams like this, it only adds to the lore because, you know, writing is just different nowadays. Back then, you know, the old timey writing and the way they describe these people, and these guys all had great nicknames too. I mean, were there any famous nicknames? I'm trying to remember now. Any famous nicknames from the 41 team that are your favorites?
The most famous nickname is Boom Boom Beck, who got his nickname because he was standing in the outfield and kind of like drifted off to sleep once, and somebody hit a ball out to where he was standing and it smashed into the fence and startled him. And he thought it was a live play, but it like wasn't for some reason. So he got the ball. He was freaking out. He got the ball. He threw it back in, and they called him like Boom Boom after that. And then there was also Dangerous Dan Littweiler, who I really like because his nickname was totally ironic. He was actually like very pious, gentle, friendly young man whose father would like his family came to every game except his father, who was blind and stayed home and listened to every game on the radio. Like he's just the most wholesome, kind guy out of Ringtown, Pennsylvania, who they called Dangerous Dan, ironically. But you're mentioning just in general the newspaper coverage of this time. It's like, it's kind of staggering to see what they would, how they would write about baseball players. If you ever read something in 2026 that you feel is too callous or mean towards a baseball player, go read a newspaper. I'm not saying you'd be wrong, but go read a newspaper from 1940 where like a guy shows up for spring training a little heavier than last year. And the reporters are like, your nickname is Fatty Fat Jackson for the rest of your career. And we're going to put that in headlines that your family's going to read. And that's just going to be how that is. And we're going to call you that to your face. There was a time in 2011, when the Phillies had their rotation and they were looking for a nickname for the rotation. And there was like this awkward moment where one of the reporters just described Fat Joe and the Terror Squad being their nickname, and then like having to explain why that is an accurate nickname for them. That is not a situation you'd run into in 1940. You'd be like, hey, they're calling you Fat Joe in the newspaper. And he'd be like, ah, nuts. Well, I guess that's it for me being called by my full name.
They're calling you Gravy Blood O'Rourke. What do you think? Good time. Yeah, those are good times. And so, you know, but you think about like, and this was like this 1941 Phillies team was historically bad, but it wasn't, I mean, it was just a continuation of bad Phillies teams throughout the 1920s, throughout the 1930s, throughout the 1940s. Really, for 30 years, the Phillies were a basement dweller, right? They were a cellar dweller. They were a last place team. And just like, so the 1941 Phillies just kind of fit right in there with all of these other teams that came before it year after year after year after year. Why did the Phillies have so much trouble being even just competent? Like, why was the level of baseball so bad in Philadelphia at that? I mean, nobody's expecting a Yankees level type performance from this ball club, but you know, to be that bad year after year after year, it's not an accident.
The Phillies at one point had an owner who was a young, lumber baron. He was the owner for exactly 1 year. I believe this was in the 30s, and he'd gotten his job because he had like started dating the previous owner's secretary. There's like a lot of these things just kind of like came together for various people in ownership roles or executive roles for the Phillies. And the easiest answer to give you is that they had a string of owners that just didn't really invest in the team. That even if they said they were going to do that, they just didn't. And that guy who was a lumber baron is a great example, because the reason he stopped being the Phillies owner is because they said, hey, man, you can't gamble on baseball. And he was like, oh, I didn't know that. After a year of being an owner in baseball. Yeah,
yeah,
totally new. So that's the level of like, that tells you the kind of owner, like the let's pinch pennies. Let's sell guys as soon as they're available. You know, let's cheer the team on when they win. But ultimately, it's going to be more valuable to me to sell the talent rather than fill the stadium with fans. But also the level of awareness as to what baseball was and what the rules were and how it was played. There were also just other owners like operating like this in baseball at the time. There were a lot of juiced baseballs at the time as well, playing at the Baker Bowl in this era. It didn't help. It helped some of their own hitters like Chuck Klein, but right. The short porch, you know, was easy. They had some pretty horrendous pitching. That was definitely, you know, guys that were historically catastrophic. And they also were sharing the city at the time with the A's. So they were fighting for the attention of one city, which is something they don't have to do anymore. But like, these are all factors that contributed to it. And there's more specific stories and anecdotes that get into this kind of stuff. But like, for the most part, yeah, they just, at the end of the day, they did not have an owner who cared as much about them. They never had their Connie Mack. And the A's had Connie Mack, and that's why the stadium was named after him eventually. That's why, you know, awards are named after Connie Mack. That's why you can picture him in your head wearing his like iconic straw hat, because he cared about the A's. As low as they felt at times, the A's actually did win, you know, world championships and stuff. And he was very interested in not only building that team, but also managing it. Whereas on the Philly side, they just never found an owner at the time that was willing to do that.
All right, last thing. On the cover of the book, obviously, is a big hot dog. And you start off your book talking about hot dogs. Where do the wieners come in with regard to this story?
Well, part of the title, it's I don't know if you can tell, but it's a double entendre in that the chief
wieners... That's why you're a writer. That's why you're the writer. You know these French writing techniques.
Yes. This is what I went to school for. Mm-hmm. They could be a reference to the very ownership groups that I'm talking about that perhaps didn't spend as much on the team as they should have. But it's also referring to the price of a hot dog at the time and the fact that the Phillies could not sell hot dogs at the time. And that if you went down to the stadium to see a Phillies game and if you went down to the stadium to see an A's game, you could have any manner of concessions. There were various counters, restaurants and places to grab a bite to eat. If you went to a Phillies game, they eventually learned we're shuttering most of these concession stands because this team is so bad. We can't even really, like, the hot dog numbers are taking a hit. So we gotta, it's more valuable to us. We're going to save more money shutting down parts of the stadium rather than trying to sell hot dogs to the handful of people that are coming out to Phillies games. And this got so bad by midseason that the commissioner of baseball was having meetings with other owners to just talk about, hey, we got to do something about the Phillies, because other teams would send their teams to Philadelphia and be like, we're making nothing at the gate because no one's coming to these games and it's making us harder. We can't buy our teams like food because there's not enough money to pay for their dinners. You know, again, these are owners claiming this, but regardless, that was the complaint at the time. So the title was referring to both the team itself and the fact that, like, they were so bad they could not even sell hot dogs, which is, you know, if a team can do one thing, if they're down to being able to do one thing, you should at least be able to get people to come to the ballpark to see a game and say, you know what, let's get a hot dog. It's a baseball game. Let's get a hot dog.
Yeah.
And they could barely even do that.
Well, here's the thing. If you've got a kid who's a Phillies fan and wants to learn about the history of the team or just loves reading about baseball, and this is like such a great beach read. I mean, you can read this in a couple of days on the beach on vacation or down the shore, wherever it is you're going to go. It's such a fun read. Like, you really just, you'll churn through this book absolutely in no time. You can get it on Amazon, anywhere. Basically, you can get books online. It's right there. And of course, it's put out by Brookline Books. So you can go to Brookline Books and get to their website, and you can order it there as well. Summer of the Cheap Wieners, what the 1941 Phillies were up to while Joe DiMaggio was making history. And there's some stuff about Joe DiMaggio in there, too, if you care about that sort of thing.
It's largely mocking and sarcastic.
Largely mocking Joe DiMaggio and Yankees fans, which is also another reason to get the book. Justin, I appreciate your time, buddy. And we'll probably talk to you in just a few minutes for another podcast or something. And that's going to do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. I want to remind everybody that if you are an audio-only podcast fan, you can find this show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever it is you get your podcast. And please tell folks that you like. And man, if there's people you don't like, you can tell them too. Tell them about Hittin' Season. Let them know that we're here. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts and you wouldn't mind giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a quick review on Apple Podcasts, I'd love to know what you think of how we're doing with the show. And also, you can see every roundtable edition of the podcast, the ones that Justin, Liz, and I do together, over on the WHYY YouTube channel. So if you subscribe to WHYY, there's a lot of other great stuff there too, but you'll also get every roundtable edition of the podcast too. Thanks everybody for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time right here on Hittin' Season.